Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's another Rebooting the News with Jay Rosen. And Jay, say hello.
Hi Dave. We have a guest this week. It's our mutual friend Dan Gilmore. For our listeners, Dan Gilmore is the author of We the Media, Grassroots Journalism by the People for the People, which is a great book on transformations in the news business in the age of the internet and the web. And he's a former tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, who is probably the first newspaper journalist to have a blog, and someone who I've worked closely with, Dave has known for quite a while. So we're really pleased to have you on Rebooting the News number 25, Dan. Welcome.
I'm happy to be here, and it's great to be on this series that gets more interesting by the week.
Well, thanks, Dan. That's nice of you to say that.
In this series, and thanks for that kind remark, we try to discern the shape of the emerging system for news and information that's sort of growing up all around us. And in doing that, one of the things we've been talking about is how Twitter is showing us the need for an even more decentralized and flexible version of what Twitter is, and Dave's been working on that, and we've been talking about it on these podcasts, and he's also been blogging quite a bit about RSS Cloud, but one of the reasons we decided to have Dan on is that he wants to understand RSS Cloud a little bit better, and I think a lot of our listeners kind of sort of get it, but not clearly. So I thought we would start by asking Dan to just sort of query Dave about that system, and maybe we can make it even clearer for our listeners. So, Dan, why don't you do that?
Okay, this is hearkening back to the old days of being a reporter and trying to figure out something that I not only don't fully get, but I'm not sure I get at all. Let me start by asking whether my basic impression of this is correct. And that my basic impression is that what we're talking about is turning RSS, which is a well-established and really quite elegant file format that lets you read things in a variety of different ways, whether that can be turned into a very close to real-time notification system the way Twitter has become. Is that
sure.
Somewhere?
I mean, it's like anything. You can pick it up in a variety of different ways. I mean, if you wanted to describe a car, you could say, you know, a car has an internal combustion engine, four wheels, an exhaust system, transmission, et cetera. Or you could say it's something that you get into to go to the shopping mall to buy groceries. You know, you can describe it at any level. That certainly is a perfectly valid way to describe it. You know, it's conceivable that, you know, RSS could have evolved to become what Twitter is, but it didn't. And Twitter broke through in a remarkable way and created something that a lot of people, including myself, love. I mean, Twitter is great. But I think that at some point, Twitter needs to be decentralized and turned into a peer-to-peer network to basically use the internet, the infrastructure of the internet itself as its architecture. So that's another way of picking it up. I don't know if that helps.
It does. let me back out of it a little bit, though, and start at... Where would someone start to use this, which is part of the process of understanding?
You know, I hear that all the time, and it's one of these things where it would be great if you could hype these things and have only the people who could use it at that moment hear about it and not anybody else. But you can't do that. Hype is hype, and everybody hears it, and that creates the expectation that you could today use it, but you can't. You know, that's the straight answer. There really isn't much you could do with it. You could You know, think about it this way. You know, we're all old enough to remember the space program, right? And the goal of the space program when we were young was to put a man on the moon. But in order to get the man on the moon, first you had to do orbital flight, right? And then you had to do spacewalks. And then they had to do docking. And you know, they had to learn how to do all these things before they could attempt that, you know, the moon mission. It's very much like that. First, that's how we do things in engineering land, is you do them a step at a time. You try to figure out what do you need first in order to be able to achieve the next result that's on the path to getting there. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, you'll have, when you use this rebooted system, Dan, you know, it. My hope is that it is virtually indistinguishable from Twitter. In fact, I think that if you use a Twitter client like, you know, Tweety or TweetDeck or Seismic or Brizzly or any number of the different ways that are already get on it, my hope is that they'll start integrating RSS Cloud features into their app the kind of the same way a stereo might integrate Dolby into its, you know, and then basically it turns into a feature that you could follow somebody who isn't on Twitter. The day that happens, you can be absolutely sure I will tell you, you know. And
okay,
I'm working, trying to get those guys to do this. You know, I think it's so much in their interest. You know, but it's that everybody goes at their own pace. You know, Matt Mullenweg is a real rock and roller, right? I mean, so Matt didn't need any convincing at all. Matt decided on his own that he was going to do this. And there are varying degrees of comfort. But until you get broad support from the other vendors in this space, there isn't going to be much that an end user can do with it.
Okay. So let's take your space program analogy and work on that. You mentioned things like orbital flights, then spacewalks and docking, and you know, booster rockets that needed to be powerful enough, et cetera, et cetera. What are the analogous elements of this that we need to have, and where are we along that process?
Sure, that's a great question. Okay, so there are three software components to this. There's the cloud software, there's the authoring tool, and then there's the aggregator. It's familiar three legs to these things. So almost all content networks have all three of them. In fact, in all cases, the content authoring and the aggregation tool are usually the same piece of software. but we're in different places. WordPress has implemented the authoring side and the cloud side, but not the aggregator side. Okay, so what that means is, you know, they've always had the ability, or for a very long time, they've had the ability to produce RSS feeds coming out of a WordPress site, right? Mm-hmm. So what they've done now is they've added the real-time capability to those feeds, which is actually very simple to do. It's just another element that you add to the feed called cloud, which has been in RSS since 2001. We had it in, you know, radio, and we had it in Manila. The software that you were using, Dan, actually had this feature. When you were using it, it had it. So they've done that, and then they've implemented the cloud component, which is, I don't know what the analogy is in the space program, but that's how, what happens is that a tool, a reader, or an aggregator, would connect up to that cloud when it notices that a feed has this ability. It then goes and connects with the cloud and says, just let me know whenever this feed updates. That's the crucial part of that conversation, right? And I have an aggregator called River 2, which I've been shipping for all of about 2 months. It's a brand new aggregator, which has many other features. I was doing it anyway. I added the RSS cloud support to that. And so right now, if you wanted to, you could subscribe. In fact, I do subscribe to many real-time feeds coming out of WordPress And when they update, I get notified immediately, and I see the changes right then and there. So that part is functioning. We've sent a satellite into orbit, and it's now out there, you know, going around the planet.
All right, I'm going to this is me asking dumb questions, but I'm going to keep asking them until
I
understand
this
better. Now, so when we talk about real-time RSS, let's talk about what basic RSS is and then what the difference is between that and a real-time cloud RSS. That is something we need to understand.
It's a phenomenal question. It cuts right to the core of it. Okay. A non-real-time RSS feed, RSS is all about change, Dan. You know, it's like, I want to know what's new. So that's why it's so integral to the news business. You know, it's all about what is new. So to find out what's new, it would be sort of like the way RSS works when it's not real-time would be like going to the New York Times website and seeing if there are any news stories there. So when you want to find out if something's new, you go to this website, you look, see if there's anything new. If there's not, then you go on. So basically that's called polling. That's what happens.
But how does that – I got to interrupt you. How does that show itself in standard RSS? What's happening with an RSS feed that is like going to the New York Times and seeing if there's a new story?
What reader do you use?
At the moment, I use several, including Google Reader, including NetNewsWire, although that's
okay. NetNewsWire
is
a great
Reader.
Example. Let's use NetNewsWire because Google Reader, all this is hidden. You can't see it. In NetNewsWire, you set it up so that it reads feeds periodically, right? Like every hour, that it just goes to look for new items.
Right.
Right. That's it. That's the going to the New York Times. The periodic scanning of feeds.
Okay, which is what most RSS readers do.
That's what they all do. That's how they all work. And that's the non-real time. I mean,
real time is different.
What happens?
Okay, I got to beat on this a little bit harder because there's something I want to understand. Why not just make RSS readers go poll stuff every 10 seconds instead of every hour?
It still wouldn't be as fast as real time. It would be every 10 seconds, you said? I thought you said 10 minutes. Because that would, your computer, well, that's good. You know, you could do that. It would really clog the internet. That's what Pointcast did. You remember Pointcast?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you see, that's the problem. If you go to, that's like, you know, just, you know, jam the network full of your polling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could do that, but we don't want to do that because we love the internet, right?
Okay, that's what I figured, but I wanted to be clear that
right.
It would
it's
the end effect would be roughly the same. How does the cloud real-time thing produce the same result without clogging the internet?
It calls you instead of you calling it. It's the other way around. It notifies you when it notifies your software, actually, when there's a change, when something new has happened, when the feed is updated. It notifies you, your software, that something has happened, and then it goes and reads the feed. And that means you get the update within seconds. That gives you your 10-second latency
right
there.
So it's what is it notifying you of exactly?
The feed changed.
And so what the difference between that and Pointcast is that the notification is a very small bit of data as opposed to a giant hunk of stuff that they send to everybody.
No, instead of 10,000 or 100,000 requests for every change, there's only one. There's a mathematical difference. It's not a matter of efficiency. It's a matter of fundamental difference in approach. It's like, to finish the analogy I was going to make before, it's as if you had your own reporter sitting at the New York Times that knew when there was a new story and would call you on the phone and say, there's a new story, go look at the site. So you could rest assured that you would never have to go look at the site because this guy down there at the New York Times knows when there's a new story and he'll call you when there is one. So you don't need to go.
Got it. So that, how do we...
That's what I've been waiting for.
Dan, so let me ask Dan a question. So if you were still your tech columnist for the San Jose Mercury News and you did this interview, what would be the piece you would write about this for the general readership of the newspaper?
Well, I've been taking notes, and I'm planning to write something that basically, and which I will run any technical stuff by Dave before I post to try and explain it. But what I think to boil it down, and this is actually something I used to do when I was a columnist, was to when I was writing about something that I was just trying to understand, I would often, contrary to the practice of the time, well, and even now, I would often call someone at a company or you know, a developer working on whatever it was I was talking about, read a paragraph or two to that person and say, is that right? Mm-hmm. If it's not, help me make it right. Mm-hmm. And but understand that it has to be something that my grandmother could understand, or if she used a computer. And often the result would be, well, you're close, but let's go through it and I'll help you get it closer. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm going to do again. But if I, top of my head, were to summarize, it would be that along these lines, RSS is a long-standing file format that basically is baked into the creation software that we all use, like blogging, like all sorts of other stuff, so that when you create a post, you automatically also create this other file with a bunch of tags in it, so that something, another piece of software called an RSS reader, understands when you have something new, and that those readers can read it in a variety of ways, such as just the headlines or summaries or the whole thing, and it's all in that other RSS file that you created while you created the regular one, and that the idea. But right now, what we do is we go with our reader. We periodically go check all of the feeds that we subscribe to see if there's something new. And if there is, it shows up in the reader. What this is talking about is adding into the RSS that we create using a field or a tag called cloud that sends stuff up to the cloud world, and that readers then have to understand, and that cloud tag goes through another server computer somewhere, and that it's right now the one we have is Dave's River 2, but hopefully we'll have lots of others that do this, and that software says aha, and it pings people who are subscribed to find out something new, but it does it really fast, so that essentially within seconds of me sending a new post up that has a cloud word in it that says I just updated, that within a few seconds the server that understands that says aha, and that anyone who subscribes to my feed who has this cloud capability built into their aggregator gets notified instantly or as quickly as possible.
Here's another way to do it. Let me suggest another analogy that might help. RSS is to RSS cloud as exchanging emails is to Gmail chat. That is, or IM. That at a certain point, the speed up becomes live and it becomes a different medium in effect. Analogous.
Yeah. That's the net effect, which I think ultimately is all that really matters.
It's the latency.
We get those things to go around, it's almost like a detail. You know, I drive a car, right? But I don't really know how it works. But I'm happy to trust the people who design cars. And I mean, this is against my own advice. I always say to users, especially guys like you, you really should insist on understanding, you know. But at some point, you can just say, look, the what's important about this is the net effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's isn't there another really critical net effect here, which is that if we have enough of enough stuff out there that uses this in highly distributed ways, where it's lots of people with many different RSS cloud creator software, plus many different RSS relay, call it a relay software, the server side, and then a many different RSS aggregator understander of the cloud.
Yep.
That we isn't the critical other thing that we have amazing redundancy and we don't have to worry about things falling over and we lose our Twitter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole point, actually. Because we already have everything that we described before that, right? I mean, I have instant notification. If you were to update on Twitter, right, I would find out within seconds, I think, you know, that you've updated. So I already have that, right? So without anything else, there's absolutely no reason to go through this exercise. So you're absolutely right. The whole point is we've decentralized and removed the central point of failure and also removed the central point of editorial control, which is the other reason, is very, very important reason, is that, you know, the Twitter guys aren't neutral. They take stands on which content they favor some content over other content. They do things that influence, you know, reporters, and not good. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you don't want a company in the center of something like this, why we like the Internet as being neutral, you know.
I think we should move along to some other topics, but that was good. It's going to help a lot of our listeners understand why we're spending so much time on this in the first place.
Thanks.
One of the key moments in this Rebooting the News series came maybe 5 or 6 podcasts in when, Dave, you said to me, we're already using the new system for news. We're already using the rebooted system, which was important to me because what it meant is that we don't just need to invent it. We need to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And describing it in practice already helps us invent it. So along those lines of we're already using it, the other day was about 10 days ago, actually, I just noticed this little tweet from Brian Stelter, who is a young reporter for the New York Times, a very web-aware reporter. And he just said, I have a blog post up about Good Morning America, and it's the first draft of a bigger story, so please comment, annotate, ask questions, poke holes in it. And I just wanted to mark this because it represents something that people like Dan and myself have been writing about for a long time, which is that the news system, the formal professional journalistic system, should learn from the blogging system. And here's a reporter from the New York Times saying that he's kind of doing drafts of his story first as blog posts and then gathering feedback and comment and then finishing it as a piece for the paper. And I don't know if either one of you have any comments on that, but it just struck me as a little sign that this new system is already here and that a lot of the conflicts and battles that get fought out, you know, over bloggers versus journalists are kind of irrelevant because the system is gradually changing under our feet.
I think Dan, you should. I think everybody knows how I feel about this. So.
I mean, what can I say? It's wonderful that that's happening. It's unfortunate that it took so long.
Exactly.
It always takes long, you know.
It does.
Yeah.
Something else I wanted to mention about this new system. This came up today in this little post that Simon Owens, who writes about the blogging world, put up. And it's about factcheck.org, which is an academic-based research unit that does exactly what it says. It fact-checks dubious claims that are circulating out there using rigorous standards of both social science and journalism. It's a former journalist who runs at Brooks Jackson. And they realized that they can't just fact-check the news, because a lot of people are getting news not from the vertical system of news delivery, but from the horizontal system of email chains and social media sharing systems. And so factcheck.org got wind of an email about Obama's health care plans or the health care bill before Congress that was full of dubious claims, and set out to fact-check that, and they eventually published their report on it. And they relied on readers of factcheck.org to alert them to this email circulating around, because it's not something you could find by reading your RSS feeds or watching the news media. And I also thought that was interesting, because that's a whole element of the news system that tends to go unnoticed but is more and more important.
Well, what they're doing is taking a page, and it's a good idea, from Snopes, which has been out there for years, doing exactly that. The site that looks at urban legends of various kinds, or legends of various kinds, and either says they're true or false, and shows you the data to back up their assertion, and completely relies on people telling them about stuff.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting that this horizontal system is a larger and larger percentage, let's say, of the news system itself, but we wouldn't necessarily know about it unless you're tapped into those horizontal networks.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to see. And they're also, that's part of a traditional journalism organization that has done terrific work in understanding that things are broadening in all kinds of ways. So I think you're absolutely right. It's very noteworthy that they're doing this.
Yeah, and they're sort of catching on. Of course, the problem is that it's hard to distribute the fact check within the same networks as the misinformation is circulating.
And it's going to be difficult to figure out what to do about that. One of the goals we might all have is to persuade at least the people who trust us, and try and make this a distributed system too, to persuade the people who trust us that when something that's a lie crosses their screen, and it's been shown to be bullshit, that they actively point out to the people who pay attention to them, especially the person who sent it, that it's a lie, and at least do our best on a fairly routine basis to counter. You can't counter everything, but...
Do you know any of these people? Because we have friends of the family who are like this, and you tell them a lie, that's more or less exactly what they want you to say. Because then they start telling you about all the lies that the liberals tell, and, and about how more, and then they just tell you more lies. I got an email from these are really close friends that for other reasons that I really like, but they have this sort of, they buy this stuff, the stuff that these people are, debunking. And, I got an email from them. This is obviously something that was sent around to, millions of people, on the celebration of 9/11. And it was this magnificent patriotic piece about how united Americans are against all this stuff. And it's like they used the word united all over the place. And I thought, this ought to be something I can respond to, because it's the last thing that, you know, I get these emails from them all the time. It's the last thing they are or that they want is unity. They want to separate, you know, this is the world of wedge politics, right? It's like separate everybody out into different factions. Mm-hmm. Even something as simple as that, I didn't even bother to respond to because I've tried responding before and it doesn't do any good. There's nothing, no minds are being changed. No minds are even open to the possibility of being changed. It's not what it's about. So it sort of seems futile to even try to debunk these things because, you know, there are those of us who live sort of in the reality-based world and are interested in discussing stuff and maybe having our minds changed about things. And then there's, you know, there are people who aren't. And, you know, I don't know that there's much point in even wasting the energy to try to figure out, because everything's wrong with these things. You know?
Well, I think what Dan was saying is that insofar as not just professional providers of verified information, but all users of the Ariba-ded system for news are distributors and redistributors
news. That's true.
That insofar as we do that, every point in the system should be a check. I call this idea the verification troops, Dan, meaning that we don't, we can't rely simply on the professional army of journalists. We have to try and enlist everybody or everybody who's open to it in the verification troops, meaning before you pass something along, ask if it's true or try to exert some sort of factual check. And while you're right, Dave, that there are plenty of people who actually don't want that, that they're in the confirmation loop, the fact is we don't know how many people are willing to play a role in verification. I don't think it's true what a lot of professional journalists believe, which is that they are the only ones between us and simply the echo chamber. There's lots of people who care whether 2 million people showed up for the march in Washington this weekend, or 70,000.
How many people showed up for that march?
Well, the best estimates that we have come from the D.C. Fire Department, and they said about 70,000, which is probably not exact, but it's probably a good neighborhood statistic. And there are people who are supporters or sympathizers with the march who care whether it was 2 million or 70,000. I think there are. Maybe they're not
there
a
are.
Majority, but there are. And so what we have to do is enlist those people in verification itself because they are repeaters and relayers of the news, and we have to make it easier for them to play that role.
You know, there was a moment of clarity that came a month ago. Guy's name is Frum, I think David Frum.
David
Republican.
Frum, yeah.
Yeah, Republican political consultant, obviously, somebody who has a mind. He wrote a piece where he said, now, what happens if we win the healthcare thing? In other words, what happens if we succeed in stopping healthcare reform? And it was a fantastic question. And, you know, Republicans, I'm not averse to Republicans. I voted Republican, I like to say, and it's the truth, I have. But I just can't, you know, and I would love it if more of their dialogue was like that. It's like, let's play it out. Let's think about the world after we succeeded. Now how many American lives are we going to be responsible for? You know, it's a fair question to ask, and I was glad to hear it. So I would imagine he would be one of the people who would care whether it was 70,000 or 2 million.
Yes.
So there is a little bit of cause for optimism, hope, or whatever you want to call it.
So one of the issues here is to help people understand that occasionally, not always, but occasionally there are consequences for believing things that are false, and acting on things that you want to believe are true, or that you're just making it up, and where their consequences can be catastrophic. We had, for example, we've had in this decade a war that was based on falsehoods. And if, you know, if we, that, now that's kind of big and for most people still sort of abstract, but to the extent we can help people understand that there really are actual consequences that can be quite negative to acting on things that you want to be true but that are false, then maybe we can make some headway. I don't disagree with you, Dave, at all that this is that in a lot of cases you just feel, well, it just isn't worth the effort. But I worry that if we give up, that we'll just end up with something completely just out of control and scary.
I think we're there. I believe we're there.
We are there. It is true, but we still have to. We have to keep fighting. I think there's a connection, Dan, between this question of verification and believing things that are demonstrably false, the consequences of doing that, and also the opacity of the systems that we're caught up in, and the inability to explain them or to make them clear. Because I think that believing just anything is related somehow to the inability to understand these complex systems, and that's related to our failure to explain them clearly and to do, let's say, what This American Life did so well when they explained the mortgage crisis to people. By the way, they're working on one about the healthcare crisis, which I'm really looking forward to because I want to see how they do it. I want to see if it's as successful as the giant pool of money was in laying bare the mechanisms by which we got into that mortgage mess. A story that you followed very closely over the years. So there's connections between this sort of refusal of fact, the opacity of our systems, and the weakness of explanatory journalism.
Or in some cases, the absence of it.
Yeah, and the absence of any will to do it. The Washington Post ombudsman looked at all the healthcare coverage that the Washington Post had done on the front page over the summer, and he found that a majority of it was about the political maneuvering, and a small percentage was an attempt to explain the problem or possible solutions. And I think that's a statement by the political journalists at the Washington Post about what really interests them, but it certainly isn't a reflection of what users want or what readers need.
Interestingly, the most, by far the best thing the Post has printed that I'm aware of this in this cycle, this debate, is a piece by a guy named T.R. Reed, Tom Reed, who used to be a reporter for the Post and who has written an incredible book about healthcare around the world, and did it was either an op-ed or a Sunday Outlook piece, I think it was Sunday Outlook, that basically just said, here's what happens in other countries. What do you think? And, you know, it was like this kind of scales dropping from eyes, at least mine, on some of the alternatives I certainly didn't know about.
Fresh Air ran, we've talked about this here, Fresh Air ran a fantastic full show about this that laid it out, where you looked at all the different healthcare systems in wealthy countries and kind of compared them to what we have in the United States. And, you know, I came out of that and wrote, you know, a 10-paragraph piece which put it all together in a summary fashion, but it can easily be done. It's and that is where the debate should be focused, because it's one of these things that it's not abstract. It affects all of us. It's the lives we lead. It's the, you know, family members that we've had who've been in the system. We've been in the system. I mean, ourselves. It's
and
not
each of
something
us,
that's hard to relate to. It's very easy to relate to.
And each of us is at an age where if we tried to buy individual health insurance, the answer would be no.
Yeah, I've been there, Dan. I've gotten the answer.
so it's a, you know, which is,
it's awful. It's unacceptable.
It's terrifying.
It's uncivilized. It's ridiculous.
I tell you what's going
to
happen.
The answer to every argument that comes out of those people is, you know, They say, well, it's a capitalist problem. The capitalist system will solve it. Well, if it's such a capitalist problem, why can a guy like me, I mean, I was able to trick the system into giving me health insurance, but boy, it was quite a process. Why shouldn't I just be able to pay the money? I don't get it.
And if they really believe what they say, they should be pushing as hard and fast as possible to do away with Medicare, which, of course, they keep expanding. The same people who say we don't want to do
because
anything.
Because logic is not what they specialize in.
Yeah. All right. That's
major.
Enough political punditry.
That's also a press issue, Jay. Journalists have been,
totally,
again, absent without leave on some of these fundamental issues. And
I'll tell you where we're headed if we don't fix this problem of explaining and also checking the tendency of people to believe what they want to believe. We're almost at the stage where it's possible to do verification in reverse, meaning political forces can actually undo what has already been established as fact. And I think this is almost like a new kind of politics where, you know, Obama was born in the United States. As far as journalism is concerned, that fact cannot be any more verified than it is now. But it is possible for politics to work in such a way to undo what is verified. And
mm-hmm.
that is a very difficult thing to stop once it gets going. We got about 4 minutes left for our inspiration of the week, Dave, and it's your turn. So why don't you tell us what you're thinking?
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you the names first and then maybe play a little puzzle and ask you to guess what they have in common, okay? Blake Ross, Joe Hewitt, Matt Mullenweg, Joseph Scott.
Say it again.
Blake Ross, Joe Hewitt, Matt Mullenweg, Joseph Scott.
Well, I only know one of those people, so Dan's going to have to guess.
Dan probably knows more of them.
I'm sure I know two of them, but I suspect I know one, but I'm absolutely baffled. But I've been out of that game a little too long, I guess, that I don't know everybody.
Well, they're all young, and that's the theme for this week's inspiration.
I'm totally with you on that.
Right, and so we tend to look for inspiration up. We tend to look at, you know, the older folks, and that's perfectly appropriate because, you know, they've had their whole lives to, you know, accomplish what they've, you know, had to accomplish. Maybe there isn't that much waiting for them, and it's nice to acknowledge that. But then you get inspired, as I have been inspired in the last couple of months by these four very young people. They're all in their 20s. And they've all accomplished great things in the early part of their lives, and they're doing great things on that foundation. You don't often see that. In other words, sometimes people achieve great things early in their lives, and that's the end of that. But what you look for is you look for people who weren't achieving the great things as part of some plan to get rich or famous or whatever, or to please their parents, you know, whatever. You look for people who have a greater mission, and all these four guys do. So what Blake and Joe did, they created Firefox. That was their first first thing that was inspiring. Firefox sort of cleaned up the mess that was Mozilla and turned it into a usable product, which was great because it forced Microsoft to start thinking seriously about their users, which was also a very good thing. And as a result, we now have Chrome and Opera is still there, so we have a good, vibrant market there. Matt took blogging tools, created WordPress. Joseph did the RSS cloud support in WordPress. And so what I wanted to say is that there's a new generation of technical, engineering-oriented, creative, I would say visionary. The thing that I love about what Blake and Joe did, Blake did Facebook Lite, which is an absolute wonderful version of Facebook. It does exactly what I wanted to see. And Joe did Facebook for the iPhone, which also simplified what has become a very complicated product, made it very, very usable. And Matt and Joseph just have balls. I mean, that's all I can say, is when everybody else looks for like for justification to do things, they say, hell, why shouldn't we? And they go ahead and do it. So,
Dave, I completely endorse this sentiment, and I agree with you. I feel the same way about young people in journalism,
yeah.
And the reason that I don't talk about the curmudgeons anymore is that I'm addressing the young people because they're going to help us through this.
Yeah, go young people.
Go.
Right on. Okay.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah. It was fun.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you again next week, Jay.
Bye.
Bye.